Welcome to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast with founders Stan Campbell and Mike Darter. If you're forced to fight the battle for your life, CCW Safe will fight the battle for your future.
Welcome back to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast. I'm Mike Darter in Oklahoma City.
I'm Stan Campbell, and I'm in Los Angeles today, Mike.
You're in sunny L.A.
I am in sunny L.A. The sun is coming through this window, and it's irritating me a little bit, but we're not doing video, so I'm okay. But, it's sunny out today. It's a little shine, and it's not too hot out here yet. I'm happy right now.
Well, man, we had, Monday night, we had, schools were closed down. It was weird. It was like Christmas. I went out driving around, all the stores were closed. There was nothing. And we didn't get a drop of rain until late in the day. They closed all the schools. I think around probably it was at night started coming. But we did have tornado. They were, it was going to be tornado again that day. And we did have some tornadoes throughout the state. But luckily, it wasn't as bad as what they perceived at first. And now it's nice. It's sunny. So,
yeah, it's crazy. We just got back from D.C. and that was an awesome time.
Oh, man, I love Police Week. Have you been to the museum, the National Law Enforcement Museum?
No, sir, I have not.
So I went, Kyle and I went one day, and that's the first time I had been there. It's across from the wall, and it was really cool. Next time we go up there, we'll have to go over there. It's a cool museum.
Awesome. Yeah. And the thing about Police Weekend and memorial services, and that's the only time that you get that many police officers together from across the world, really, but especially across the nation. And, 10 to 12,000 officers in one place, pretty much remember those who we've lost, over the years and that prior year specifically. So it's a good time for everybody to get together and, show that bond.
Yeah. It was hard to walk through that wall, man. The actual memorial, because I walked through that as well and saw some letters from, I saw one letter from a girl who, I think she was graduating high school now, and her father was killed when she was, young, 2-3 years old or so. And it was a kind of a letter to her dad. So it's pretty tough, going through that and, seeing everybody who's affected. And, when these things happen, when an officer is lost in the line of duty, it's not just that single loss, it's a loss to the law enforcement family. It's a loss to his family. And it's a big loss.
That's right.
So it's a good time. We had a good time. And speaking of Police Week, that's kind of what we're going to be talking about today. And we have recently rolled out a HR 218 plan for retired and former officers. And it's a new plan that was based on kind of what we had done for New York. And we decided that there's a really great new organization here in Oklahoma that we decided we wanted to support. And we decided that what we're going to do is every year we're going to choose an organization or association, and we're going to donate proceeds from that HR 218 plan to. And this year we decided on Warriors Rest, and it's based out of here, Oklahoma City. We have Brad Shepard on with us. And welcome, Brad. Thanks for making it. And we wanted you to kind of just give, why don't we start out with kind of you giving a background of your background, and then we'll go into Warriors Rest.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to get on here and talk about Warriors Rest. Mike, I'd love to. I'm a 25-year retiree from the Oklahoma Highway Patrol. Retired as a captain at a command level. I had a really wonderful career. I retired happy. But I had to work really hard to retire happy. So many guys were in a business that we have to kind of qualify that retiree. Did you retire happy? No, I didn't. I'm mad at the department.
Which, yeah, that is.
A lot of anger out there, right? So I had middle chapters of my career. It was about 7 years in there that were pretty angry. In fact, I talked a lot about in my leadership classes about getting kicked out of three units in my career. Most of that was all that anger I was carrying around, right? Yeah. So in doing that, I actually retired and built a nonprofit foundation called Warriors Rest Foundation. And our sole mission is to build peer support teams and bring recruit counselors into the first responder and law enforcement industry so that we can help folks get and stay healthy. It's a pretty crazy career that we choose. It's a noble and an honorable career, but at the same time, it's very difficult. A recent statistic that came out on a research study was that law enforcement on average has 188 critical incidents in their career. So if you add that up, even if you're on average, you're going to have a hard time getting through a career with dragging those critical incidents around by themselves. So that's a little bit about me and kind of the platform by which I've worked for about the last 27 years.
Awesome. Hey, Mike, I'm going to dig a little bit deeper into him.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, Captain, what really made you decide to become a police officer? Because I'd like to find that out, you know. Why did you choose that profession?
You know, that's a great question. It's actually more of a spiritual quest for me. It was a spiritual calling. I grew up a farm boy in western Oklahoma, raised on a dairy farm, and I actually wanted to go back and do that, but realized that there wasn't enough money in that thing. So I wanted to get rich, so I went into law enforcement, right? Actually, was called. I felt a very spiritual calling going to law enforcement, and had no law enforcement family, had no law enforcement relatives, nothing. But had a straight calling to go into law enforcement, and I was very fortunate and actually lucky that the Highway Patrol even hired me. But they hired me on, and I did. I never looked back.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing about that, you know, people don't realize, and when you talk about there's a calling, you know, everyone has a different reason why they become a policeman. And I really do enjoy when you can tell someone's being genuine about it being a true calling, because like you joked about, and like Mike and I know, when we first started, there's really no money in it. I mean, you don't make a lot of money. We started off $10.35 an hour, you know, and that's just $2 above, you know, minimum wage back then.
Well, it was ridiculous when I first started out. I was newly married, and we qualified for food stamps while I was employed.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. A lot of those before us did qualify for food stamps. And, you know, I mean, when you put yourself in a position like that, you know, it really takes special people, you know, because you come in there and you're gleaming and you think you're going to save the world and you save your community. And then you realize that it's like, wow, I'm actually hated out here. And I'm hated because of the uniform that I wear. It's not me personally. And, you know, it's hard, you know, to deal with that. You know, Mike actually did a video recently about some of his photography, and Mike, tell everybody your quote, because I love that quote about, you know, why you did what you did and what we see as officers.
I said that you're talking about the
seeing people at their worst,
therapeutic. Yeah. So I just kind of talked about some of the things that I'd been involved in, and I had a pretty, you know, I had a pretty rough, probably 5 years, or, you know, in a 10-year span, I lost my older brother next to me, who was, you know, like my hero. You know, worked the Oklahoma City bombing, got in a shooting, got sued in federal court, lost my left eye. And all that happened within a 10-year time span. And I said in that I've seen the best of people at their worst, the worst of people at their best, and everything in between. Mm-hmm. And to be able to, you know, get out. And that's one of the big things with my photography, that, you know, it's kind of therapeutic for me to get out and, you know, into nature. I do a lot of wildlife and nature. And those of you that don't know, you know, check out my, I have a website, jmdarter.com. That's a photography site. I'll shamelessly plug it. But I love wildlife and nature photography and do that. Stan, I was going to ask you, why did you get into, you know, I don't know if we've ever talked about that. Why did you get into law enforcement?
You know, I'm terrible about being honest. You know, it was dare, actually. You know, my cousin was joining the fire department, and I went with him on the ride, and he filled out his application, and we come out, and I saw the police department over there, so we kind of giggled and said, "Hey, let's go fill out some applications." So I do it. I found out you get a car that was so much cooler than being a fireman. And I was like, okay, this might be pretty cool. Well, then I actually got it. And I was like, wow, I'm a police. I was only 21 years old. You know that because you were about the same when you went in. And it took the academy for me to realize, I was like, you know what? This is an honorable job. And I actually always had this in me, you know, because I've always been a protector. And I didn't realize, you know, because I grew up in the mean streets in New Jersey, and those policemen up there, you know, I got family up there now that are policemen, so I'm not going to talk about all of them. But back in the early 80s, they weren't that friendly. And so I didn't really like police at first. But then once I got in, you know, I was like, you know what? I'm going to make a difference, you know, just like I'm sure the two of you said as well. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make a difference for my community, and I'm going to get out here and I'm going to do what's right and make it. And because you can't just complain about things. I mean, if you want to make change, you have to be involved with that change and create solutions. So that's what I did as a young one. I went inside and I figured out that I actually had an internal calling. But, you know, a lot of times, you know, from the spiritual side, we start going on a path that we're not supposed to go on. Sometimes windows of opportunity open up for us that we weren't expecting, that God places before us. And policing was one. And that's why I did what I did. That's my reason.
You know, I don't know if we've talked about this on the show, my reason for it either. But I remember when I walked in from my board review and you were sitting there, and I was like, man, this guy just stole my job.
Yeah. Well, I would say the same
thing
to you.
He's going to get hired and I'm not. Do what?
I was going to say the same thing to you because, you know, they already told me, my recruiter told me, said, well, you know, they already got their five blacks. Now, this is no joke. This was affirmative action back then. So I was like, oh, man, I'm number six. And it's not cool to be the sixth man. Not in basketball, not in affirmative action. I was like, okay. So I saw you and you were so perfect looking. Like your hair was like the way it is now. I've lost all mine. But I was like, wow, this guy, this young, oh, man, he's beautiful. I said, he's going to get it. I was so happy that both of us got it that day. So, yeah.
Hey, you know, before I became an officer, I always wanted to be a Marine in the Marines. Yeah. I always wanted to be a Marine. And I went to enlist after high school because I didn't know, you know, I got accepted to Pratt Art Institute up in Brooklyn. I was like, I don't really want to do that for like a living. And so I went and I had asthma when I was like 15 years old as a kid up to like 15. And then I played through it in high school sports and stuff. And so they were like, oh, you can't have it past 12. Asthma past 12. So I was like, well, shit, what am I going to do? So I went to OU, got an OU and went and they got contacted by the ROTC and they said, hey, we can get you in through ROTC. So I was like, okay, cool. So I went there, went in and about after the first semester, they're like, hey, we wrote letters and we're not going to be able to, you know, we're not gonna be able to get you in. Mm. And the guy could tell that I was like, just devastated. I was just like, oh man. And, you know, I met a bunch of friends that were going through ROTC and so he's like, man, just go back. He's like, they don't keep records. Just go back. This is like in 87. Just go back and just lie. Don't tell me you have asthma. So I went back, reenlisted, told him I didn't have asthma.
Yeah.
And I got all the way to the very end to like the day before. This was like a few days before you get sworn in. You have to go do a last physical.
Yeah.
I went and did the last physical and I had a kidney infection. I was like, okay, I see I'm not supposed to do this.
Yeah.
I looked and, you know, police had always been kind of up there. If you're wanting to be a Marine Corps, you know, you respect all those roles. And so I went to a police department, you know, that's one of the things I say that, you know, is one of the best things that worked out for me. I wouldn't be where I am today if it weren't for me not wanting, getting what I wanted, you know, when I was younger. So,
yeah.
But I loved the role as a police officer. So, oh,
absolutely.
Let's talk about Warriors Rest. Now, you guys, I know you and Brett both pretty well. And you guys have done some videos, which I'm going to put the video. They have this story that is an amazing story. Stan, you watched it the other day.
I did. I mean, it's a tearjerker.
It is. It's a really good story. I'm going to put that whole, it's a long, it's what, like a 15, 20 minute video?
23. Yeah. I think it's 23 minutes.
23 minute video. But if you're in law enforcement, you got to watch this. And if you're not, you should watch it.
But, yeah, because you know, the thing about it, what people kind of miss, especially with law enforcement, you know, it's not just the shooting incidents that piles on us in our minds, you know, that we file away because we do see the evils that men do. But, you know, but when you do have those critical incidents and the shootings and you're there with someone that you spend, someone that's a friend, that's almost a family member to you, and they get shot and go down or you get shot, you know, there's something that has to kick in, you know, a survival, you know, that deep thing that we all have within us to survive has to kick in. And, you know, it's really important to listen to stories like this, even if you're not law enforcement. Listen to the stories and listen to the will to live and, you know, the mindset of, you know, being strategic and, you know, trying to figure out how do I handle a situation when I'm outgunned. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's all within us. We just all have to kind of dig deep and just figure it out, you know. But yeah, I love the video. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I shed a few tears on it because even when you hear cops talk about shooting or stuff like that or losing a friend, you know, it sparks memories within. And we mm-hmm. all think back to, you know, who we've lost over the years and the situations that we've been involved in.
Yeah, Brad, can you tell us about, and I'll put the story on there, but can you tell us about kind of how you all met that guy?
So his name is Ed Smith. He's given us permission, in fact, to tell a piece of this story, and up to it, including giving us a video testimonial. But Brett actually met him at National Police Week a year ago. Mm-hmm. Ed actually walked out of a session. He became so overcome with emotion that a session that he was sitting in that he had to get up and leave, and Brett followed him out. The short story of that is Brett had a conversation with him that sounded a lot like this. You don't have to live this way. Decades he had been in a place where he thought he was just going to have, that was how his life was going to be. And in one session with the counselor, utilizing a therapeutic technique that's pretty, pretty innovative and new to the culture. Well, I say new to the culture. It's not well known, EMDR. And in one session, it changed his life. I had occasion to actually see at National Wellness Conference later on last year, November of 2018, Ed's wife, Gail. I actually got to witness Gail walk up to Brett, grab his neck and say, "Thank you for giving my husband back." That was
wow.
An emotional sight to really watch and see how impactful that just Brett connecting Ed with a good counselor. So yeah, that's the backstory of Ed and his service to his community, Modesto, California, and his event. So,
and that really gives people an idea. I wanted you to tell that story because that gives people idea really of what you guys are. So let's talk about that. Tell people what exactly you do and the things you provide for others.
Absolutely. We We actually are a three pillar based nonprofit. The first pillar being we build peer support teams. We're a firm believer that peer support, the cops will utilize partners before they'll ever step through the door of a counselor. So we train these police officers in crisis intervention techniques and wellness techniques and put peer support teams together and replicate ourselves as fast as we can out here across the country. The second, under the peer support build, Dr. Kathy Thomas, our clinical director, she's recruiting and mentoring counselors into the law enforcement and first responder industry as well. She's trying to get counselors to come to this industry, but also at the same time, teach them and communicate to them that, hey, we're a different we're not your average person that you see in a counselor's office. There's some cultural differences. There's some communication differences. We have our own language that we speak within law enforcement and first responder culture. So there's a lot of things in conjunction with how she trains and mentors. But the second pillar of what we do is wellness. We really want to bring wellness programs and presentations out to the field of resiliency. How do you have a healthy marriage? How do you have healthy kids? How do you have healthy finances? How do you eat right in this crazy industry? It's pretty easy. Mm-hmm. Donuts all day long. But can you go and how can you eat and stay healthy? Substance abuse, substance addiction, suicide, intervention, prevention, all those wellness programs. One of the really neat things about what we're doing is we have contracted subject matter experts to build little train the trainer programs that we can give away that content to a peer team when we do a peer team build. The most recently, one of the ones that I like the most had a substance abuse counselor build us a train the trainer program so that we could hand that content to a new team. Say, here, go teach this within your agency. So the team doesn't have to be a subject matter expert. But those little wellness programs are pretty exciting. Just so you can get a peer team out there having a dialogue. Let's talk about some hard things. Let's talk about marriage in crisis. Let's talk about our kids not getting along. Let's talk about nutrition, finances, all these little things. Let's have conversations with them instead of ignoring them. And it goes back to a little bit of me personally. One of the things that helped get me out of my dark place was a friend that wasn't even in law enforcement. My law enforcement partners they weren't okay, but they were. It's culturally accepted for a law enforcement to stay in that dark place, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
angry. That's okay. You know, laugh it off and get the dust back, knock the dust off, and get back in the game. And it was a friend outside of law enforcement said, "Hey, why don't you not stay there? Let's do something about this, right?" So, it's about this wellness is about opening up a line of dialogue about talking about hard things that our culture doesn't normally talk about. Yeah. And the third thing that Warriors Rest does is we're actually peer support and counseling services ourselves. God's given us a talent, so that's what we do. For example, coming off of Police Week, we take a team up to Police Week and work under the support services umbrella at National Police Week every year. New families and returning families that have a difficult time navigating Police Week with all the emotion of it. We provide peer support and counseling services to those families at National Police Week. And it's just an example. Support services at National Criminal Enforcement Association's National Conference. We provided peer support counseling services there. Since we've opened the doors, we've done several hundred crisis intervention one-on-one pieces with our team. So that's a little bit about what Warriors Rest is, the three-pillar based system, in just a quick overview.
I love that.
That's awesome. Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I think back about what you just said, in the past couple of minutes, people don't understand, officers – they're really not quick to get help for themselves. And the agencies at a whole, just generalizing across the nation, they're not really up on I know there's a few. I think LAPD, they have counselors for their officers that they hire and keep on full time that you can go see. Many officers do not reach out for help. You know, a lot of times they keep it with their partners, or sometimes depending on the partner, because some of the partners might be a little abrasive. You know, it's not really, as a community, a police community, it's frowned upon to say that you hurt or that something makes you sad, or because they see that as a sign of weakness sometimes. So that's, I'm sure you have to battle through that all the time, don't you?
Right. Absolutely. Those there's pretty commonly talked about. There's two acceptable emotions in law enforcement: anger and humor.
Yeah.
You can't laugh about it. You have to cry about it. And Dr. Thomas calls that many times masking emotions. What we as a culture don't want to do is recognize that what those emotions we're masking, which is sadness, loss, hurt, pain, fear of all manner of fears, fear of actually doing our job, or fear of losing a partner, or fear of losing a family. I mean, all those things add up to real emotions. Those really exist. But oftentimes what happens is we suppress those down and we hide those with being angry. Hence, going back to what we were originally talking about with retiring happy or retiring angry, right? Mm-hmm. Some people are retiring angry. Well, maybe they're not angry. Maybe they're hurting. You know, just like Ed, as an example, his was loss. He was dealing with loss for years and had recognized the fact that, hey, this is just me. This is the way my life is going to be. Yeah. Except for the fact that it doesn't have to be that way. The song we sing is about that you do not have to live this way. We say that so many times to people, to officers that we're sitting across the table from and having a conversation from, and saying, hey, you don't have to live this way. There's another way to live. So you're right. There's so many more emotions out there that we just have a tendency we have a tendency to ignore those. Because it's culturally unacceptable to walk into an office and say, I am sad today.
Yeah, you're right. And then, you know, and you're right. I mean, we're all over that dark humor. And, you know, I think about back when, you know, because Mike and I, we've had, I mean, there was a lot of our friends that had a lot of experiences with the Oklahoma City bombing. I myself, you know, I was in federal court on that day, right across the street. But on the south side of the building, although we felt that the bomb hit, I mean, was detonated in our building because of the way it shook and the effect that it had on our bodies, you know, we found pretty fast that it was across the street. And myself and the three others that were with me, we were the first four that entered that side of the building, had to deal with the death and destruction, you know. And then just like Mike, we had to work the thing, you know, in the weeks after. You know, my particular job was one of the guys who worked the temporary morgue. And it was a rough experience. And, you know, and I had to relive that thing every single year because the bomb was detonated on my birthday. So every time my birthday comes around each year, I have to think about the bombing. I see the images of it because everyone kind of, you know, they put up there, we will never forget, you know. But, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times I want to forget. Right. And it took me actually 20 years to actually even acknowledge that it was hurting me within. And, you know, I had a breakdown, you know, 20 years after holding this in and dealing with the pressures of it, you know, dealing with some friends that, you know, at least one friend that committed suicide from it, and a lot of friends that ruined their police careers because of what happened mm-hmm. at the bombing. And so I ended up, you know, finally writing an article called The Bomb, The Bodies, and PTSD, where I kind of told my story, which I'm going to try to see if Mike could share it in the link well. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was the only thing that I found that was therapy for me initially, was getting the images, putting it on paper. Is that something that you guys suggest as well, that you don't try to find other ways of getting it out?
Absolutely. Journaling actually is a really effective therapeutic tool that can be continuous, that you have control over. You know, a lot of that, we're that enforcement industry, we're all control freaks, right? So we try to implore things to these officers that they have control over, that they can do themselves, that they can do managing things on a daily basis to actually help navigate whatever post-traumatic symptoms they may have of whatever critical incidents they're coming out of. So journaling is a great way. You know, there's so many things that are you can be proactive about being healthy, but our culture is just not prone that way. Our culture is just prone to absorb it, swallow it back down, and keep on going. Your mission first, get to work, and then you know, go back to Gil Martin's book, make a reference to Dr. Kevin Gil Martin's book, Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement. That's the comfortable place for law enforcement. That's what it says in the book. Look, that's your comfort zone. So we run back to that comfort zone. That's what we're trained to do. That's what we love doing. We know we make a difference on a daily basis. But yet at the end of the day, we're still not acknowledging these emotions, these things that are real, you know, that really do exist. We can ignore it all we want, mm-hmm. you know. Again, I'll go back to the Ed. Ignore yeah. what you want 45 years later, it's still there.
That's right. And then, you know what, you know, when I think about it, for those who are concealed carriers that are listening to us, although this episode is leaning toward police officers, I mean, I want you to know that you're still human, and it's actually still aligned with what happens to you. And, you know, because human nature is just not natural to take a human's life. And I'll tell you right now, we've had a lot of private conversation with some of our members that's taken lives. You know, they too have thoughts of suicide. And this is one of the reasons why you guys really need to get the help. It's one of the reasons why we designed our service so that we provide, you know, some assistance and, you know, getting grief counseling and such, you know, a licensed counselor to help you through what you're going through. Because even as a concealed carrier, as a policeman, you know, none of this stuff is natural. And when you do it, anything that you actually, you know, any type of critical incident and that you've witnessed or that you've been part of, it is filed away in that brain and it's not going to come out. And when it does come out, you're not going to be ready for it unless you get help and know what's expected.
That's right. There's just because law enforcement has probably statistically more, that doesn't mean that people out in everyday world walking around doesn't have the same challenges of living a healthy life after they've been dealt a pretty crummy hand of a critical incident. Losing a loved one, you know, by itself, that's pretty heavy. So you're naturally going to have some grief things, you know, depending on the nature and connection of it. Everybody has a roadmap. Everybody, Dr. Thomas talks a lot about, you know, they have the roadmap, which is how we're made up, how we're wired, all the events that we've been involved in through the course of our life from the time that we were little to current. And all those events and all that roadmap plays a part in how we'll deal with critical incidents whenever they come down the road. Some people are more resilient. Actually, the PTSD statistic is a little bit higher on average for law enforcement, and say that's arguably because law enforcement is a little more resilient because their background, their history, and their patrol school or their academy or their training that they go through, they're taught resiliency on some levels, but they're also taught to ignore some of that. And our advocacy, what we're preaching from the mountaintops here is, if you've been heavily impacted by that, then let's seek help. Let's have a conversation about it. Go to somebody, go to a trained peer support crisis interventionist, go to a counselor who's trained in trauma, not just a social worker counselor. I go to a counselor who's actually been trained in dealing with trauma and those types of situations, and do it on purpose. That's kind of our call.
That's one of the things in my shooting that the peer support aspect of having that I see a civilian not having, or a citizen who is out has to act. You know, when I came out of that house and there was an officer there to grab me and walk me to the car and say, "Hey, man, you're good." You know, and having that immediate peer support, and then the peer support going through the whole process in law enforcement, is there that if you're a citizen that you're not going to have. Now, you may have it with your family, but you're not going to have that immediate because you're going to be locked down by law enforcement if you're just defended yourself in a shooting. So that's why it's so important to, you know, realize this stuff. And we've talked about the physiological effects that you go through after a critical incident, and to be aware of those, to know about those is big. Now, Brad, you were talking about one of the stats that I saw. I was trying to remember. I think it was like 10% of like people involved in critical incidents. There's only about 10% of people experience chronic PTSD. Most people get through that in a series of days or months. Is that right? Or am I off on that? I don't remember what I was reading.
Well, you can kind of death by stats, and depending on what statistician you want to follow, it can vary there. But yeah, there is a statistic out there that is, and I don't remember the exact number.
Yeah.
It is significantly reducing the PTSD if you can get that person talking about the critical incident early on, which is the crisis intervention piece.
Okay.
Critical incident stress management. So that's the crisis intervention piece. So a person immediately within hours and then days and then a couple weeks after, if you can get that person talking, what we know to be true is that the more you tell your story, the better you process your event. Mm-hmm. So that lessens the opportunity for PTSD to be established. Those symptoms have to be, at least, I'm not a clinician. This is just stuff that I've read personally and stuff. Those symptoms have to last longer than 30 days for you to start considering being diagnosed with PTSD. So the PTSD is, just because you go through a critical incident doesn't mean you're going to have PTSD. Mm-hmm.
Right.
But if you can get a person who has been through a critical incident, and if you can get somebody in front of them talking to them and having them tell their story and regurgitating what happened, and then start regurgitating the emotion with it. I was scared. That scared me. That hurt. I was hurt. I had loss. That pain, whatever those emotions may be, that really dramatically lessens the PTSD issue.
That's one of the things with Ed's video. I noticed, you know, today in law enforcement, they typically say, like if an officer involved shootings, they'll do, you know, they'll say either two sleep cycles or 24 to 48 hours before they're interviewed, because like you said, you have to rebuild that, that incident. You have to really kind of, talk about it and get it out to really get a firm understanding in your own head of what went on. And I know I experienced that with mine. It was kind of like, you know, I remember like, you know, 8-10 hours later, sitting on the couch thinking, what happened? You know, trying to piece it together. In Ed's case, back in his law enforcement, which this was common back then, he drove back to the station, changed his clothes, and went back to work, which is unthinkable for it today, knowing what we know today, to go right back out to work. You would have to immediately push all that back and just push it back and file it, or try to file it, just to get through the day. So that was one thing in his video that was just amazing.
Absolutely. I can't even imagine anybody with the education and understanding we have now of critical incidents and what they what the impression they make and leave on our bodies and minds and souls. The industry standard is, hey, take them offline. I can't imagine anybody out there, an agency, not knowing that. To the agency having the liability of understanding, hey, I'm going to take this person out of his bloody clothes, and I'm going to put him in a clean uniform and have him go back to traffic. That's just unheard of in our current day and time.
And that's one thing you guys do correct, is you do training for agencies on peer support. And
that's our main mission is to do peer team builds, mm-hmm. build a peer team, not just train individuals in crisis intervention, but to put teams together. What we believe is that teams survive better and agencies are aided better in having a full peer team. And we look at really doing the 3 to 4 days of the crisis intervention piece and then 2 to 3 days of the wellness piece so that that peer team actually is not just reactive in nature to critical incidents, but actually can be teaching within their agency certain things about suicide prevention and substance mm-hmm. prevention, those types of things. So absolutely, that's part of what we do is train those and really ask those agencies to say, hey, consider this. If you don't mm-hmm. have a team, consider this because we know it saves lives.
And you guys have been all over the country, right? What are some of the departments you've worked with?
We've been as far as Alaska training up peer teams. Wow. It was just up in Illinois. We've been to South Dakota, Illinois. I'm kind of brain dead coming off of police.
Yeah.
But
yeah, yeah.
Those are some of the places that we've been most recently. We're in the process. We've either built or in the process of building or mentoring 26 teams now since we've opened up the doors last January.
Wow, that's awesome. And the second pillar too is so important to get, because if you don't have not able to, you know, handle a critical incident positively, then everything's going to be affected down to your finances to everything. So that's really cool how you. That I think that second pillar is very important. In fact, in our case with Stephen Maddox, you know, the peer support or the critical incident coordinator at the time was John, was put together a healthcare a diet plan and a workout mm-hmm. plan just to try to keep him positive during that. Because if you're a citizen and involved in a shooting. Kind of like an officer. So if you're a police officer involved in a shooting, you have administrative, criminal, and civil actions that can come forth. Administratively might be something within the department. It might be losing your job to losing your position to being put in a different role. Criminal charges being pressed or civil action. And that's the same thing with somebody who is a civilian. And you have to stay positive during that time. And it's hard. It's hard to stay positive when you have critical stress going on or you've been involved in a critical stress incident and you don't know what's going to happen next. And you have all these pressures on you. And then you have all your internal things going on. It's hard to stay positive during that. And you have to stay positive for, those times. If it's a criminal case, that case may be 2 years later.
That's you're exactly right. You're spot on, Mike. That's a rabbit hole that you can go down and really have a hard time getting out of. And what comes to mind immediately is that self-doubt piece. Mm-hmm. I remember experiencing that. You know, you're involved in a critical incident. Did I do this right? Mm-hmm. Then you start questioning your own actions. You start questioning your own decision making. And then further down the rabbit hole you go, you start experiencing, along with the self-doubt, you start experiencing this negative, these negative thoughts of self. Well, I should have done this different, or if I'd have done this different, this outcome would be different. And you just further down into that rabbit hole you go until you're really down there so far, it's so dark you can't see out. And that's when we get phone calls. Hey, needs help. I've got a police officer that needs help. And we, our hope is that we get to them and we can help them before they end up doing something dangerous to their career or mm-hmm. dangerous to their family or even danger to themselves. Mm-hmm. But yes, you're exactly right. That begins with really small steps and just keeps going till your next thing you know, you're in this really dark place. So to your point, where is you really have to help these people stay in a positive point And I love what you're talking about there, which is giving them an action plan. You know, here's what to say to yourself every day. Here's what you need to go out and do every day. Here's how you need to eat every day. Exercise. I love the fact that you're bringing up exercise. You know, cortisol plays a huge part in this, and that's your stress drug, your fight or flight drug. And the more you worry, the more you get it, and the more you have it in your system, the more difficult it is to get up and do anything. So exercise and has a lot, huge part to play and all that. And I'm not a physician, but the endorphins and the oxytocin, huge part in getting yourself into a really positive place. So you make a great point there on that, staying positive.
Yeah, and Stan mentioned earlier, you know, we both seen just from the bombing, we both seen, you know, a handful of people on our department go experience different things and just get into that where they just get buried and they either end up dead or they end up in prison or, you know, and, you know, he was talking about that earlier. We've seen both of those, and it's something that, I mean, this is very important. This is something that we tell our members, you know, if you're going to carry a firearm, you know, these things are not just a one-time action that you're going to take and then it's over and I'm back to my normal self and work, you know, and it may not be, you know, a lot of people think that, well, you know, I don't think I'd be affected that way. Well, even if you weren't, you know, a lot of other people, your wife may be, your kids may be. Absolutely. So it's a whole process.
Yeah, that's point too. There's a ripple effect there with a critical incident, vicarious trauma, secondary trauma. It exists. It's real. Within law enforcement, there was a recent small survey. A counselor here locally had done a survey, and it asked police officers, "Do you think your kids were somehow traumatized by your career in law enforcement?" And it was upwards of 75% of the officers locally here within Oklahoma City and Oklahoma High Patrol that said, "Yeah, I think our kids were affected by my career," and that's. You're not even having to go home and talk about the critical incident. You're just different, and they recognize the fact that you're different. And so they're impacted. Your family's impacted. Your loved one's impacted. Your marriage is impacted. So, yeah, that's a great point. I knew a officer that had two shootings about 2 years, about 18 months apart, I think is what they were. The first shooting, he had very little effects from the shooting. He didn't really have, and that one was very violent. He had about 18 months later and was heavily impacted by it. And it was a pretty simple cut and dried. If there is something. Pretty simple cut and dried shooting, but he was heavily impacted. So you just never know. You just never know how you're going to be impacted or not impacted for some of these. But in addition to that, that vicarious trauma is a big part to consider. For your concealed carry carriers, just from our experience.
And you'd mentioned the self-doubt. You know, that's one of the and I'd love to meet Dr. Thomas sometime, Brad. I'd love to maybe get her on the show. Yeah. And she sounds like, you know, we have had a really good connection with Dr. Artwall, Alexis Artwall in the past. It sounds like they're very similar. And that self-doubt, that intense second guessing, you know, was one of the most common in law enforcement, one of the common physiological effects. And that's one thing, whether you're a law enforcement officer or not, you know, that you need to be aware that, you know, like Brad was saying, I could have, should have done this. I could have done this better, should have done this. And, you know, when you're being interviewed, that's not the time to let those things come in. There is a time for that. Maybe I don't know how you deal with that, but you know, if you're being interviewed whether you're law enforcement or not, if you're being interviewed on a shooting case, you know, you have to really be aware of that and know that that is not the time to let those come in. Those should haves and could haves come into your thought process. But yeah, I'd love to get her on sometime. And I haven't, unfortunately, when you guys have shot your videos, I've been out of town both times. So maybe sometime we'll be up there.
Absolutely. No, she would be, not speaking for her, but I think she would love to come on and talk about it. She has an amazing story. And that goes back to the bombing. For her to get on here and tell her perspective of the bombing. We've been talking on and off about the downtown. Her perspective is, she has a great story. It'd really be good.
Tell her that I would like to talk to her and I know she's probably busy, but sometime I'd like to get a hold of her and talk to her and get her on the show.
She and Gary Berryhill are actually in Baltimore at the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation's World Congress. We were selected to present one of our proprietary blocks of instruction up there, and Gary's presenting this week. So Kathy's so they're representing us real well up at ICISF World Congress this week.
Nice.
Awesome. Pretty excited about that.
Hey guys, before we get off, I wanted to just slide in real quick before we start goodbyes and let everybody know for those officers, if you guys don't have something like this at your agency or you're looking to get something built or you just need some assistance for yourself, go to warriorsrestfoundation.org, warriorsrestfoundation.org. And then also for those who are having dark moments or, you know somebody that is, they also have on there the Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-TALK, 1-800-273-8255. Thank you. I just need to get that in.
Yeah, and I was going to make sure that we put that website on here. And they also have a donations page. They have a support where you can do donations and you can do recurring donations. This is something that I just like to say, Brad, we're super proud of your organization, not only because, we know you guys are from Oklahoma, your hometown guys. And, we're proud of what you're doing and, we've supported you in the past. We're going to support you in the future. And, even if it's just, if you would like to help support that, you can do a small, recurring donation. This is a great service. And I'm just really looking forward to seeing what you guys do, because just in the last year that we've talked, it's awesome.
We've done some pretty incredible work. I just finished up some of our numbers, since we started keeping statistics last March. And we've been in front of nearly 3,000 first responders to date. We've done 791 crisis intervention one-on-one sit-downs with officers and or their family members. Mm-hmm. 17 suicide interventions.
That's awesome.
That's some of the numbers today currently, and we just keep getting more phone calls. And to your point, Stan, I'll add this too. We actually are on Facebook. There's a lot of people reaching out to us on the Facebook. We're not heavily into social media yet. Our marketing expert told us to get one social media up and running and get it going well. So we chose Facebook first. We look forward to getting on Instagram soon. And you guys are the heroes on Instagram. You guys do some crazy good stuff on there. So love following you. So I don't know if we can keep up with you there, but thanks for pointing out the website. We actually get a lot of reach outs on the website as to, mm-hmm. can you come talk to my officer, or can you swing by and call this person? They're having a hard time. You can email us through that Facebook site as well. So thanks for that. I'd also like to add this too. HR 218 thing that you got going on, which is in the end going to probably end up producing some money for us on donation. We are speaking on behalf of Brett and the entire team. We are very, very honored by what you are doing with us and for us, to select us to be your first entity to donate to. So thank you for that on behalf of the entire team. Kathy, Gary, Gary Isbell, Brett and I, we're super honored by this. And so thank you so much for doing it. Appreciate you.
Man, you guys are doing great things. You're going to continue to do great things. And I look forward to keeping close with you guys for a while. So thanks for coming on the show. And go to Warriors Rest Foundation. Sorry we weren't on last week. We were at Police Week, but this is going on today, and then we're going to get it back on track. So, all right, guys. You guys have a great day.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Be safe out there.
See you, Mike.
Thank you. All right, bye, buddy.